Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
My name is Terry Jackson, and the group that I'm with here this morning, we're going to do things a little differently in that we're going to use the same amount of time, but I'm going to invite two of my colleagues who have been real leaders on this initiative around giving a community voice to what it means to actually bend the curve and end the AIDS epidemic in New York. Have no disclosures. This has really been a multidisciplinary endeavor to develop community tools to help those living with HIV and those who are concerned supporters about what this really means. So ACREA has led this initiative in putting together this multidisciplinary group, which includes providers who are of note, such as Donna Futterman and the work that she's done in the Bronx, Asa Radix, who is one of the foremost thinkers and providers of transgender people. And I was asked to come on board as a person who has spent over 20 years of their career, the first part of their career, in providing direct services in HIV clinics, et cetera. And now I actually do health communications for a private management consultancy firm, whereby we build out leadership platforms such as ending the AIDS epidemic, ending TB. If you go on the WHO site, you may see some of our work in that we actually work with senior level leaders of countries, of companies, to build these types of platforms. I do agree that it does take an advocacy voice to sometimes bubble it up to the top, but I want everyone to have some key takeaways here in that these types of things also have a communications voice behind them. They have a machine. It's like some people would liken it to Olivia Pope or what have you in Scandal. And I mean, I have to be completely honest with you. It is filled with key messages. It's filled with opportunities for, media opportunities, et cetera. And that's what I currently do for a living. So I was asked to come on board and look at this through the lens of, well, what does this ending the AIDS epidemic mean in terms of the signal that it's giving? What is it not signaling? And what does that mean from a person who's been on both sides, now health communications and looking behind the curtain, but also being on the ground floor? So we're going to start this off with Joe from ACREA, who's going to provide us with the context.
Good morning, everybody. Joe Lunovitz, Deputy Executive Director for Programs at ACREA. The context or the frame that we're using for this this short presentation comes from our quarterly community health education and advocacy tool called ACHIEVE. It's a magazine that is free. It has a subscription of about 12,000. It serves people living with HIV and AIDS and their providers. It's a very health literate piece of journalism that we're really proud of and that's used in an advocacy perspective. And the articles that you see up there, we'll touch on a number of them, but not all of them because of time. So you've seen this. What I want you to do is think of it a little differently right now. I want you to think of these three pillars of Cuomo's in New York State and the plan to end AIDS, plan to ending the epidemic platform, right? Three pillars. Test, identify and test, link, support, retain, apply, so there's viral suppression, and then last is using PrEP as one of many tools, but the idea of adding in a biomedical tool is very specific. Think of them as leverage. Leverage to do what, right? Leverage to decrease the number of infections more than they're already decreasing now. We've got, and to give you some context, we've got about 20 years of success in New York State, really across the country, but specifically in New York State because of the work that's been done. New York State's a resource-rich community. It is when it comes to HIV and AIDS. So things work differently. We're also like the number one place where HIV and AIDS is living and breathing. So those two things go along together. So the context. In the mid-90s, New York State had about 15,000 new cases of HIV per year. So get this, 15,000 new cases. In 2013, we've got 3,300. Today we've got an estimated 3,000 we're looking at, so a reduction of another 300. The idea is to do better. Right, of those 15,000, some areas where we've done really well, for example, our perinatal transmission, about 200 cases in the mid-90s. In 2013, 2 cases. To date in 2015, 0 cases. I mean, think about that. This is what got Cuomo and all AIDS advocates, Charles King, all of the organizations that were talked about earlier, so excited, is you start to see where, when you apply pressure, it works. Right? Injection drug use. About half of those 15,000 in the mid-90s, 7,500 infections came from sharing of injection drug equipment. In 2013, that number goes down to about 100. From 7,500 to about 100 because of programs like syringe exchange programs. Right? Syringe exchange programs. In and of themselves, huge impact, but also the way the state has been dealing with this. So that's our context. We've got leverage and context. And then we've got this bending the curve diagram, which some people find a little confusing. I love it, though, because I think if you look to the left where it says new HIV infections and HIV deaths, see that the lines are parallel, but they're going down. So you've got 20 years of parallel, but going down. The numbers here, you've got 3,000. Imagine mid-90s to the left, the graph's extended, you've got 15,000. Now we're down to 3,000. Okay. Notice where the arrow is, and new infections goes down. It's being pushed down by leverage. That's the point. If you apply more pressure, if you don't give up now, but you actually do more, if you apply pressure, you will end the epidemic. You will get the numbers down quicker than another 20 years. Right? Even though we've done well, this is an opportunity to do even better. So if you do the math, for those of you who've read the book The Martian or seen the movie The Martian, let's do the math, right? What you can see is they planned it out and they said, if we apply pressure, at what point will the number of new HIV infections go below the number of HIV and AIDS deaths? At what point? And if you look up top, the epidemic, total number of New Yorkers living with HIV and AIDS, 2020, if you get the number of new infections down below 750, you'll see that top curve bend. That's our context. So of those 3,000 new cases in 2015, here's what we need when it comes to where do you apply leverage more specifically as opposed to the three pillars, which are very general. Here's some ideas for specifically where to apply leverage. So that's still 9 new cases of HIV infection and 5 AIDS-related deaths every day in New York. You know, when you put it that way, it still sounds like a pretty massive thing that's going on. In 2013, 72% of the 3,300 new HIV cases were in MSM and transgender women. Here's where you need to apply pressure. You need to do more work because it hasn't been done well enough. 2013, over 25% of the new cases were in young MSM. So young MSM specifically, notice the age range, 13 to 29. There's actually 2 groups in there, and we need to start looking at them as 2 groups. There's adolescents, and there's young adults. There's a difference, right? 13 to 18, 18 to 25, 26, socially very different human beings. Functionally, very similar. Because of the development of the prefrontal cortex, it's not fully developed until you're about 25, 26, which means your decision-making process, your ability to say, hey, maybe I shouldn't do that. Right? It's not fully developed until you're around 26. But they're 2 different groups, so we need to start looking at how to apply leverage for 2 different groups, right? Nearly 1/3, nearly 70% of new HIV cases in people of color, we're still not doing well enough. There's still racial disparities. We need to improve there. Nearly 1/3 of people newly diagnosed with HIV have had concurrent AIDS and HIV diagnosis within the last 12 months. The majority of those, more than half, are 50 and older, which means that, for example, for 50 and older, we're not doing sexual histories. We're not asking about HIV testing. Even though it's written into the law in New York that it's supposed to be routinely done, it's not being done for all groups the same. Last but not least, lack of quality HIV surveillance for transgender New Yorkers. It's still not safe enough for transgenders, even in New York. Right, so I'm going to turn it over to Terry. She'll pick up from here.
So Joe spoke about putting the pressure on. What are the levers that have to be pulled in order to end the epidemic? So I'm going to go over some of the challenges, in terms of leveraging the resources to put pressure on and to bend that curve. Healthcare settings that respond slowly to legislation. Joe spoke about that in terms of, we have laws in place in terms of HIV testing, but we know on the ground that in some cases it's not happening. I thought that Naomi's presentation was really interesting in that, getting providers to adopt biomedical initiatives and things of that nature, it lags behind what we want the claim to be. There are only so many providers that Naomi's program can reach each and every year. It's going to take a huge Herculean lift. There's funding threats. Year by year, we know that the funding arena changes and there's contestation over who's getting what, when, and how. Also, we know that stigma, something that we really don't talk a lot about, but we know that it's alive and well. For instance, Mira's presentation on folks who won't even disclose their HIV status for insurance purposes. And let us not forget about multiple morbidities and what it takes in terms of not just treating HIV. For some clients, that's the least of our problems. So I want to look at what some of the required commitments are in terms of ending the epidemic. What we know as healthcare professionals is that we have to fire on all cylinders. That means we need public health policies in place that support care coordination. We need a healthcare system that meets the needs and can create wraparound services for individuals. We need medical providers. We need a groundswelling of medical providers who can communicate with patients and have them become active participants in their care. And we need people living with HIV to become, have the skills to self-manage their chronic illness. So what's the gap between the needs versus the commitment? For instance, Karen talked about the budget. If you really look closely at the documents, the estimated need in terms of the estimated budget that was requested was in the land of $281 million. We ended up with an investment of $10 million. That's 10% less than what the estimated need was. So what does that really mean? And what's the critical question? We have an underfunded plan. When a plan is underfunded, we know that it doesn't have the optimal opportunity for success. So I want you to walk away with three critical questions. Does New York State's investment signal a serious commitment to ending the AIDS epidemic? Also, is the blueprint just good public relations? I don't tend to be on the cynical side. Living through the HIV epidemic and working in direct services since the 90s, I'm actually happy to be here and talk about the potential of ending the AIDS epidemic. And also, given the strong history of activism with the HIV community, will activists actually use the dashboard and demand a real effort towards ending the AIDS epidemic? Now, Mark is going to come up and talk about the importance of community education and mobilization in this effort.
Hi, thanks. I'm Mark Milano. I'm an educator at ACREA. And so to close with the patient perspective, I've been living with HIV for 34 years, and I know how important it is to be educated to deal with this disease. When the SurveyMonkey went up for the blueprint, I was one of the first to submit a proposal. And my proposal basically read like this. Even if we identified every single person with HIV in New York State, and even if we got every single one of them into care, and even if somehow we negotiated with drug companies, as we did in New York, to get all the drugs for free, so there was no financial access, even if all these utopian things happened, we would not achieve the 80% biosuppression the plan needs in order to succeed. And that's because there is such a huge barrier on the individual level to getting into care, staying in care, getting on treatment, and staying adherent. Excuse me. So people need to understand why they need to be on treatment and how it works in order to stay virally suppressed. Here's some of the stuff I've heard from people in my workshops of the last 25 years. How many have heard this? HIV drugs are more dangerous than the virus. Have you heard this from your clients? I hear it all the time. The cure exists, but it's being withheld to make money for drug companies. HIV was created to destroy people of color, a very common misperception. Magic Johnson has been cured of AIDS. I hear it all the time. HIV came, I have a client right now who is treating his HIV with herbs and vitamins only. His CD4 count has dropped from 500 to 200 in the last 4 years, but he refuses to go on the meds. I'm sure we've all encountered that. And I heard this, I take half my doses to protect my liver. Half your doses, right, is the prescription for disaster. So we have to deal with all these misconceptions that are out there in the community. You know how important adherence is. WHO estimates that only half of people take medications as prescribed. Most studies with HIV show about 70% adherence, but you know HIV treatment requires 95% adherence to maintain viral suppression. So that's a real problem. So how do health educators come into this? We, clinicians, do not have the time to sit down and go through all the various details of how and why HIV treatment works. And also, patients are oftentimes reluctant to ask or admit certain things to doctors because of the power imbalance, because of the fear of being reprimanded. It's difficult sometimes for a patient to speak to somebody in a white lab coat honestly and completely about what's going on in their life. So as a health educator, we are trained to translate these difficult medical concepts. I can make anybody understand peak and trough levels with no difficulty. And I think it's important for people who are on HIV meds to understand how they are different from high blood pressure medications. We can explain those differences so they understand that. We had the time. I just spent 2 hours last Wednesday training a group of 12 people with HIV on how HIV medications work. How many doctors have 2 hours to explain how HIV medications work? I know that people have disclosed things to me on a regular basis they have not disclosed to their doctors because I can establish this trust that sometimes is more difficult with a clinical provider. And especially in a group session, when I say, how many people here are taking Sasiba? People raise their hands and one person says, I'll never take that drug because I hear it gives you crazy nightmares. And the person right next to them says, I've been on the drug for 5 years. I have no problem. That's a powerful tool to use. So what happened was, luckily the blueprint is a living document, and I went on Facebook and I said, I'm really upset that my recommendation was not accepted, and I went to the committee and I said, this should have been accepted. We talked about it. They agreed. The AIDS Advisory Council, I'm happy to report, last month unanimously approved this statement saying, funding is needed for CBOs to ensure that all people with HIV, in regular care or not, have access to comprehensive HIV education so they can make informed decisions about starting HIV treatment and staying adherent. I think it's a critical piece of the puzzle, and I'm really glad that the blueprint is open to accepting new ideas like that, and it's going to get better as time goes on. So here are all the authors in ACHIEVE. Feel free to email any of us with any questions you have. And the issue is available online at acrea.org. Click on publications and you can download a copy of it. I think there's a lot of good data in there, especially talking about can you replicate the New York State plan in the South, which is something that I think is a very different question to ask. And Arisha Bowers from Tennessee answered it very well. Thank you very much.
We have 8 minutes for questions here in. Not questions to anybody. Do we have a mic? Would that go to the mic?
Mike does not travel.
Mike does not travel.
So we can repeat everyone's question. In the front.
Oh,
thank you.
That's all right. But thank you for the moderator. Let's give everybody one final hand of round of applause for their excellent presentations. Question in the front? Yes.
Well, I'm at JSI, and come find me after this, and I'll tell you the exact location.
Any other questions for our fabulous presenters? In the back, gentlemen, you
could
stand and speak loudly.
Sure. My name is Jeremy.
We're far enough along to be able to answer that question. We're not necessarily seeing that just yet. Stuart, have you seen anything? Sorry.
We've had occasional scary language in some states where in encouraging enrollment to make day options, they kind of use some harsh language about people moving off Ryan Live and on to APA, but that's been the exception rather than the rule. I think most states have understand that Ryan Live continues to provide a very important set of background services in addition to the completion coverage they do in terms of supporting premium payments, co-payments, deductible payments.
And the Ryan White program continues to support all of those wraparound services as we know the behavioral health services are sort of the last to catch up in terms of what's getting covered under the Affordable Care Act. So I don't think anybody's pushing too hard on that, as that's the last really huge part of the curve.
On the plus side, we've had contact with a few jurisdictions who have found significant cost savings in the APA era in terms of reduction in the amount of money they have to spend directly on medication, primary medical care, and even premium assistance. And so that's enabling potentially more resources to be made available for things like behavioral health.
Thank you. Another question in the front line?
I have a question for Karen.
Yes.
The development of the blueprints in New York, I'm from Quebec, and we're trying to speak to the health minister to try and get him to at least commit to the World Health Organization objectives of 1990.
Yes.
Hopefully to end up with a blueprint that's similar to yours.
Okay.
What kind of arguments did you use to convince the governor? What, it's not just you, but the 42 different organizations that sent a letter to the governor. What kind of messages did you use to try and convince the governor that this is something that needs to be done?
Right. So I think a couple of my colleagues here on this panel have spoke to the kind of great things that have already happened and making sure that pressure is being put on the issue. I think I am able to share that letter, so why don't you take my card, because then you could actually read what the letter stated. But I think one of the biggest pieces that I've heard is that, you know, a lot of times you have actors coming to get, like, their own organization saying, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to do. But it was a letter joining everyone together saying, this is the vision that we have as an organized community. And one of the main things was, let's develop this task force. There's a little bit of background there, that there was, under Medicaid redesign, there was also a task force that formed in New York State, and so building upon those principles is something that they used as well, and that had been shown to be effective. So I take my card, and I'm almost positive I'm able to share that.
Great, and I'll just add something to that. 42 organization plus coalition, you can imagine how hard it is to put together. And how that hard is to maintain. And in the epidemic coalition is still in existence and still pushing to get the blueprint implemented. You can hear each step of the way requires an incredible amount of advocacy, pressure of a different sort, right? Advocacy pressure. And a lot of people still moving together in the same way. But like
creating a task force.
You know, it is, but at the same time, when you see the stats and you look at the numbers around HIV and you see that this is an opportunity, you know, that we really live in a time of change and opportunity with regards to ending the epidemic. And when you get that in front of you, and you get that in front of 42 organizations who are all moving in the same direction, that common goal is really good, very helpful.
one of the tools we had in New York State was the fact that current governor is the son of Mario Cuomo, who founded the Institute in 83, and so there was a real sense of pride that New York State has always taken the lead, and let's take the lead again. But let's not forget, this was an activist pressure thing. It would not have happened unless tons of pressure were put on the governor to do it. So it only worked in any situation if you get the community activists screaming for this. That's what you have to do.
Right on. Thank you for your question.
I just want to ask to the question that came first. I'll be at booth 1506 at 1506 from 12 to 2.
In the last 1 minute, do we have any additional questions in the back?
I think the author who wrote the piece in Chief, and I urge you to look at her article, said that basically certain basic concepts of the New York State plan, you know, can be used, but you're right, because the South is so much different from New York State, and because each state in the South is so different from each other state with various infrastructure differences, that you'd have to carefully look at each individual state to see how it's going to work. So what the author basically said is that activists in each state would have to come forward and say, here is our plan to end AIDS, maybe modeled on New York State plan, and then begin demanding one of the specific needs for that state. So I urge you to read a written article. I think it's great, and does go into how you would fine-tune this for different situations like the South and even like Canada. You know, it has to be changed. The epidemic is different in every state, and the plan to end the epidemic will be different in every state, absolutely.
Thank you for your response. Thank you definitely for your question. Any other final words? Do our panelists have any marching orders for folks in the audience?
This is the ending the epidemic website.
Read the blueprint.
Yeah.
And demand this, you know, scream and yell. We need people, not only people with HIV, but everybody to be saying it is possible to end AIDS, and the officials have to do it. It's going to come from you if it ever happens.
One thing I was just going to mention very briefly, I mean, using current events really helps things too. So, for example, I don't know if you heard about the Indiana outbreak. Yeah. So, I mean, making sure you're pulling at things like that and saying, here's a targeted current event that's showing how necessary it is for us to be implementing programs. So, just trying to stay on top of that type of thing too, will only help.
Thank you to our speakers and definitely thank you to you all for coming. Have a great day, everyone.